Well, good morning and welcome once again. My name is Lori. I'm one of the pastors here. And we're going to continue a series today called The Songs of Christmas. And we've talked about different songs and how they've related to the Christmas story. We've talked about Hark the Herald Angels Sing our first week and how the angels, the highest of high beings, and we talked about the shepherds, the lowest of low beings, according to societal standards anyway. And last week, we talked about the Magi, the wise men, and the long and exhausting journey they took to meet King Jesus. And today we're actually going to go back to Matthew 2. We're going to go back to that text we were in last week, and we're actually going to go a little further in the text through verse 18, because we are going to hone in on another character in this story, the villain. Every good story has a villain, right? Except this isn't just a story. These are real life events that happened some 2,000 years ago. And Matthew, the author, tells us like it is. He keeps it real. This is written not as some warm and fuzzy Hallmark card. It's disturbing. And today, I just want you to know that as we talk about disturbing things in the text, disturbing things in our lives that may be happening, that this message is really timely for me personally. We have some disturbing circumstances going on. And I know that some of you do too, or you're walking alongside someone who is. And so how we handle that really, really matters. We've probably all had, to some degree or another, a disturbing circumstance around us. But as I was preparing, there's one that really came to mind for me that really takes the cake. It was at least 10 years ago or so. I was in my car on an early spring day. And you know, it's one of those days where it's been a really long winter. So even when it's not that warm out, like it's spring, people, everybody's driving around with their windows down. That was this day, about 10 some years ago. And I was making my way to my hairstylist. She's way out on Alpine. I'm loyal. She keeps moving and I just keep following her. So I'm out on Alpine, and an Alpine and 4 Mile, are you familiar with this intersection? It is crazy. Lots of traffic, lots of lanes. The intersection there is just huge. And I found myself at this intersection, and I'm just kind of jamming to some music. And all of a sudden, I'm like, why is no one going here? And I notice that there's this guy who's kind of making his way in the very center of the intersection. And he has this real life, like legit samurai sword. And he is swinging this thing around and doing all kinds of crazy jabs. And I'm like, what makes this even crazier? You can't make this up. This guy was in nothing but his whitey tighties. Straight up, fruit of the loom, okay? So here he is, and I think finally what happened is there was someone that was like, I'm done with this nonsense. You know, I got a meeting to go to. And so they drive around the person, or attempt to. And then it happened. The guy turned on him and slammed his sword. It doesn't even feel like a real story as I tell it, but I swear it's happened. So slammed the sword on this guy's hood. And that's when I began to get scared. And I think people around us were too. I wanted to make sure my doors were locked, made sure my windows were, everybody's like rolling up their windows around me. I'm on my phone. I see others on their phone. No doubt everyone's calling 911. And within a couple of minutes, a whole bunch of cop cars came to the scene. I don't know how several cars even got through the traffic to get in the center of the intersection. But when that happened, one of the cops I saw kind of get out of his car and go to his trunk. The trunk had popped up, and out he comes with a rifle. And I'm like, I am going to die on Alpine Ave today. What in the world is happening here? Thankfully, they were able to contain the person, get him handcuffed and in the backseat of the car safely, and traffic began to flow again, and everyone was on their merry way. My only regret that day was that I didn't get a picture of it. But it was so far, it was so long ago, I had a flip phone then, so it probably wouldn't have even been that great of a picture. And come to think of it, it probably wouldn't have been that appropriate to even show you here. And if you're a teenager here today and you're wondering, like, what's a flip phone? You can ask me later or ask your parents later. Point is this. This guy was absolutely disturbed. And he had done a really good job of creating fear and chaos all around him. Just like the villain in our story today. A little context before we read. Matthew is writing to a Jewish audience, and he tells them that their Jewish Messiah is going to be the savior of the world, king of the Jews. Now that is really, really, really good news. Unless you are sitting on a throne pretending to be a Jewish king, which is exactly what King Herod was doing. He had been put in power by the Romans and given the title King of the Jews. And so in his mind, Herod's mind, if the Jews begin to get this idea and hear that a Messiah has been born, a new king of the Jews, there's going to be some rebellion against his rule. So where was his rule? Well, Herod was appointed king of Judea. Now, oftentimes we talk about the Sea of Galilee, right? And the religious triangle. That would be north of here if you follow the river up. What I want you to pay attention to today is what I have starred there. This is where our story takes place. It takes place in Bethlehem. And King Herod was known for being paranoid and a madman, but he also did some really fantastic work. His reign was known for his splendor and his creative handiwork. It could be seen all throughout Israel, including rebuilding the temple. This temple was the largest, most magnificent temple in ancient world. And he built other temples and palaces too. You may have heard of this one, the Herodium. That's where this is. I'll show you the map first where Herodium is. It's about 3 miles southeast of Bethlehem. And this is, the thing with Herodium is it was a man-made mountain. And you can see the next picture. These are the ruins of it. It was a fortress, a town. And Herod wanted to be the highest mountain above any other God-created mountain. So he had this mountain made in this fortress. It was massive, as you can see, even just by the ruins. Okay, more on Herod later, I promise. But let's jump into the text, and we'll make a bunch of stops along the way. Matthew 2, verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw a star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, with all Jerusalem with him. Well, we know why Herod was disturbed, right? This was a threat to his throne. He was the king of the Jews, not some up-and-coming baby king. But why was all of Jerusalem disturbed with him? Have you ever felt uneasy and fearful or anxious just because someone next to you was? There's some videos that have gone viral recently of somebody pranking a friend. Maybe you've seen this. There's two people walking outside of a house, and one person, the person that walks out first, is the prankster. And the person, you can just see it in the video, out the front door, the shot's perfect. Someone's walking out, and all of a sudden, they're ducking, and they're looking all around. Well, the next thing you know, the person behind them is doing the very same thing. They have no idea why. They're just doing it. They're so connected that they're feeling scared and anxious because the person in front of them pranking them is. It's crazy. Anxiety is contagious. The only difference here is that the people of Jerusalem do have a reason to be anxious, to be fearful. Herod had a track record for being ruthless. He was known for his many murders, including his own family. His own family wasn't even safe around him. He murdered his wife and then later named one of his four towers of his palace after her. Gee, thanks, lovey. But he also executed two of his sons who were falsely accused of plotting against him, then killed another son who had falsely accused his two brothers. He killed his brother-in-law, his mother-in-law, his uncle, and even on his deathbed, Herod so craved honor that he had some beloved nobles arrested. And in his mind, the plan was the day he died, these beloved nobles would be executed. In his mind, that would ensure that there would be mourning on the day of Herod's death instead of celebration. Pretty demented, right? Well, if you want to look up the story later, you can, but that plan actually failed. Herod died, and they actually released the nobles. Whew, on that one, right? But by the end of the text today, you're going to see that wasn't all that he was willing to do. This guy was paranoid. The ultimate power of Herod brought ultimate fear. It was not fun to be on the other side of Herod. And the text says when King Herod heard this, the news of the baby king, he was disturbed and all Jerusalem with him. Well, no wonder, right? They were surely thinking, what is this guy going to do? With a word, people die. Just feel the anxiety and the fear here. Verse 4, when he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. Well, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, they would have been the perfect choice for Herod to glean information. The chief priests oversaw temple worship in Jerusalem, and they were trained experts in the law and how the application of it. And here's how they responded when asked where the Messiah was to be born. Verse 5, in Jerusalem, in Judea, they replied. For this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be shepherd my people Israel. Okay, so now he knows it's in Bethlehem. In verse 7, when Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared, he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. And as soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. Now, of course, we, unlike the wise men, have the advantage of knowing how the story unfolds, right? Not only is Herod a phony, but he is a big fat liar. He is not, he is in search of the child, that is certain, but his intention is far, far this extreme from worshiping that child. Verse 9, after they heard the king, they went on their way. And the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother, Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now imagine this moment for a moment. Just feel what's happening. This must have been so awkward, to say the least, to have these important men, but strangers none the least, come to your home. This was not normal, even in this day. And then they bow down and worship the young child, and they give him gold because he was a king, and frankincense that was used in worship, and they gave him myrrh, an expensive burial spice, because this king was born to die. What a day this must have been for Mary. And where is Joseph in this? The text really doesn't tell us. Maybe he's off to work. Who knows? I kind of imagine him coming home and Mary sitting down at dinner and saying, "Well, you will never guess who stopped by today. Caused quite a ruckus in the neighborhood." Who knows? But this was epic. Verse 12, and having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, he took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. You know, I have read this text dozens of times. Maybe you have too. But it hit me like a ton of bricks this week. The weight, the burden that Mary and Joseph must have felt as they left their town, got settled into Egypt, and likely knowing or hearing the report later that the young mothers that they left behind lost their sons because Herod and his men were searching for theirs. Who could blame Mary? Had she questioned God or cried out, "Where are you? Do something, please move"? These emotions and desperation, I imagine some of us in this space could even feel that today. The rough population of Bethlehem, according to archaeologists, was between 1 and 2,000 people. And so, you know, looking at the average birth rates, it's presumed that in the vicinity of 25 to 50 precious baby boys under the age of 2 were killed in this event. Horrifying. Just horrifying. Verse 17, then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. a voice is heard in Ramah, which is 5 miles north of Jerusalem, weeping in great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they were no more. You know, sometimes I lose sight of the fact that we are in a spiritual battle. I get caught up in the circumstances and kind of get a little tunnel vision. Maybe you can relate to that. But behind the evil King Herod, we see the enemy, or at least the work of the enemy. And just to be clear, we all know the work of the enemy, right? It is to steal, kill, and destroy, period. And the Apostle Paul says it this way in Ephesians 6. He says, for our struggle is not against flesh and blood. It's against the rulers and the authorities and the powers in this dark world and the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. This was a spiritual battle. And friends, we too are in a spiritual battle. This world is not how it was intended to be by God in the beginning. And the question, I think, for us today is, what do we do in the midst of it? How do we get or stay steady when a situation around us is wobbling and people around us start to wobble? What do we do? Well, there's a social experiment done on Candid Camera a long time ago. If you're 40 plus, you might recognize Candid Camera, right? Remember the show? Yeah, everybody watched it on like Saturday Night with Hee Haw or something, you know? But check this out. It's just a short clip.
The gentleman in the elevator now is a candid star. These folks who are entering, the man with the white shirt, the lady with the trench coat, and subsequently one other member of our staff, will face the rear. And you'll see how this man in the trench coat tries to maintain his individuality. But little by little, he looks at his watch, but he's really making an excuse for turning just a little bit more to the wall. Now we'll try it once again. Here's the candid subject. Here comes the candid camera staff, three of them at least. And this man has apparently been in groups before. Here's a fella with his hat on in the elevator. First he makes a full turn to the rear and Charlie closes the door. A moment later, we'll open the door. Everybody's changed positions. Now we'll see if we can use group pressure for some good. Now, in a moment, on Charlie's signal, everybody turns forward. There it is. Notice they take off their hats. And now, do you think we could reverse the procedure? Watch.
Oh my goodness, too funny. This may just be a funny experiment, but the point is, we have a choice to make when things around us just aren't right. When our world is being rocked and when things seem so out of control and we can't seem to fix it. Just imagine the hopes and the fears that Mary and Joseph were carrying in the text from today. And just to make really practical, what hopes and fears are you carrying right now? What's disturbed in your life? Maybe you're worried. Maybe you're worried, will I have enough? Things are tight right now. It's the Christmas season. I'm not sure how I'm going to be sitting in January. We're turning into an election year. And last year you had this friend 4 years ago that just would not stop. And you almost lost a friendship because of it. And now we are turning into another year and you're not sure if your friendship's actually going to withstand at this time. Maybe you're wondering for Christmas, you have parties coming, and will that family member, will they come? And if they do, like, how is that going to go? The truth is, I am shaking both of these bottles equally, right? But we both know what would happen if I opened this one. Yeah? How we respond when our lives are being shook is up to us. And when things are out of control, there is something we can control. We can choose to put our hope and our trust in Jesus and remain anchored in him. And don't mishear me here. What I'm not saying is you're not going to feel sadness if you trust in him. You're not going to feel pain. You're not going to feel angry. That is not what I'm saying at all. But we have a choice in that to not conform to those ways. I love how the prophet Isaiah says it in chapter 26, verse 3. He says, you, meaning God, will keep in perfect peace those whose minds are steadfast because they trust in you. There's a beautiful Christmas hymn, the one we're highlighting this morning in our series, called O Little Town of Bethlehem, that reminds us of this. One of the lines says, the hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. Hopes and fears are our realities in our life. And when we allow Jesus to meet us in those places, we can experience his peace, even in the midst of pain. And so I just wonder today, what would it look like for your hopes and your fears to meet up with Jesus this Christmas? Would it bring the kind of peace that you and I long for? Do you ever look at someone going through a really disturbing time and just wonder, like, how in the world are they coping right now? How are they withstanding this? I know I have. One of my friends and a person on our staff named Bruce, he's on our tech team. Today he's actually behind the scenes working the switcher doohickey thing. That's why he's there and I'm not. But I was talking with Bruce at movie night. He was here running tech. And I said, Bruce, I'm preaching this Sunday, and I've been thinking about our hopes and our fears and how we handle those. And I'm thinking of you. I'm thinking of your story. And I wonder if it'd be okay for me to share a piece of it. And he gave me permission to share with you today. And the reason is because I see him like this water bottle. His world was and is being rocked, and he's steady. About 10 months ago, his son, Andrew, was diagnosed with cancer, and I remember meeting with Bruce and praying with him and hearing him just be so real and raw and saying, I trust God, but oh, I got some words for him right now. I am angry. Why my son? He's so young. Why not me? 5 months later, just 5 months ago, if you're doing the math, Andrew passed away. You may not know this about us, but as a team, our worship team huddles up right here on Sunday morning, and we pray for the service and for each other and for all of you, and our kids team does the same thing out there. I love that about our church family. And this grieving father has prayed several times in that huddle for you. He's prayed for you and for people like you that are going through a similar circumstance, that are suffering and grieving and in pain, praying that your hopes and fears will meet up with Jesus. He didn't use those words, but that's exactly what he meant. He was praying for an encounter for you. That's his heart. Bruce told me that there is not a day that passes that he does not miss and hurt for his son. I just appreciate his vulnerability so much. Bruce, I know you're probably watching right now, doing the switching, and I appreciate that so much about you, that you would say, I still go to bed at night crying myself to sleep in pain. And at the same time, he said, I know God's with me. I know I can trust him. And Bruce has this hope. He has this hope because not only does he know Jesus, but Andrew knew Jesus. And so he knows one day they will be together again. And Bruce said it, and I quote, "And this short time on earth will seem like nothing." He said to me, I don't do this perfectly. I said, I don't either, Bruce. We don't do it either. We don't do it perfectly either. But thanks for modeling what it looks like to trust in Jesus and believe that he's good no matter what. This world is groaning, and God is near. He is Emmanuel, God with us. Our hopes and our fears can be met in him and him alone. Why don't we sing just a few lines of that beautiful Christmas hymn together? Oh, little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Yet in thy dark streets shine the everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. Let's sing those last two lines again. The hopes and fears of all the years are met. Would you pray with me? Lord, for this truth, we thank you. We thank you that in the midst of hardship, in the midst of our spiritual battles, you are Emmanuel, God with us. We praise you for your sovereignty, for your great love for us, that you would leave glory to come rescue us and bring us hope, both now in our living and in eternity. We thank you for the beautiful reminder of this table, communion, that in a wobbly, messy life, we can huddle up together and get steady once again as we remember and celebrate the hope we have in you. And everyone said, amen.